WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. If you are wondering what Stuart Copeland, the songwriter, film composer, and of course drummer for The Police, was doing 46 years ago on this day, you can find out in his new book, Stuart Copeland's Police Diaries. The entry for October 24th, 1977 reads in part, check drum shops, airport, new hotel, H-Docs, airport again, sting, hotel, studio, Chinese dinner. Stuart Copeland's Police Diaries is made up of journal entries from 1976 to 1979 before the band hit big. The book documents Copeland's other musical endeavors and the founding years of the Police, their earliest successes, alongside the trials, tribulations, mundane chores, and all the curry dinners that came with them. Here's a couple more examples. Saturday, May 7th, 1977, Sting's Folks, Lunch, Pick Up Car, Drive to Cambridge, Howard Mallet Club, Told 31 Records, Good Gig, Punky. Lost truck key, took Sting's car home. Thursday, September 7th, 1978. KK mixing in the morning until 6 p.m. Calypso, Police arrived, but Sting and I went home early. Dead tired. The KK in that last entry is Clark Kent, Copeland's debut solo album, a record that earned him his first hit on the charts before any Police song made it there. He'll be reissuing a deluxe version of that album next month, and he joins me now in studio. It is so nice to meet you, Stuart.
Well, it's nice to be here with you.
So this book focuses on 76 to 79. Within a decade, the Police will be playing Shea Stadium, one of our favorite places, people who remember Shea Stadium.
Where one of your crew I just met was there.
Oh, right on.
She was there at Shea Stadium. This is not about that part. This is about the starving years.
Yeah. What did you learn about yourself revisiting that time?
Well, how hard work it was, the grind of it. I mean, as you just said, you know, wake up in the morning, go down the other side of London, pick up the truck, drive back, pick up the gear from Sting's place, and Sting, go to rehearsal, rehearse all day, drag the gear back, just like, just grind upon grind.
Yeah, it's the get in the van years.
Yes, yes, yes.
What is something about your creative process, the way you work now, that's pretty much the same from back then?
Well, the musical instincts are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. The only thing that has changed is the skills. And as you go through the decades of life, you actually get kind of better at it. Your skill set improves. But the actual musical identity is there from birth, I believe. Mm-hmm. As I've discovered, you know, I once revisited an opera that I wrote 20 years before because they had a different they had a much bigger orchestra for it now. So I went back and discovering it, that's exactly what I would have written today.
Oh, interesting.
But I've got more skills now, but the music identity is implanted at birth, I think.
How has the technology changed it?
Oh, my gosh. In olden times, you had to play the music your darn self. Now you can get a machine to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And not only the playing part, but the composing part, too. And the technology has leveled the playing field and democratized the process so that, you know, the good news is that anybody can make music on their laptop. That's a wonderful thing. It widens the talent pool hugely. You know, artists like Moby would never have made it in olden times because he doesn't play guitar, to my knowledge, any particular instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But he was able to make really interesting music just by using the technology that enabled him to make cool records. That's the upside, is that for music lovers, there's all this talent that now hits the airwaves. Bad news for the talent is that every damn fool's making a record, and getting noticed and pushing through is a lot harder.
And also some of them, and I've had this conversation with a songwriter about how some things sound the same, but it's because they're not bringing in individuals to play the drums. People are sampling and using the same sounds.
Yes.
And I think something gets lost there.
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. You know, my kids are grown up now, but when I was still driving them to school, I would get my education and what's hip. And my last daughter, you know, graduated and is now here in New York City, actually, a Wolf on Wall Street. But she, you know, driving her to school, she would play her music and I would mm-hmm. be educated into the current zeitgeist, which ended up, you know, Kendrick Lamar. That's the last thing I heard. I have no idea what's been happening since that. And
that's a good place that you can stop there. That's
yeah,
okay.
yeah. But you know, all my friends of my generation are really threatened by Kanye and the rest because there's no musicians there. Where's the musicianship? Well, the musicianship is in the concept. Mm. And finally, the tyranny of guitar-based drums has been broken, and people are making great music without using completely different tools and speaking a different music language. That's a good thing.
My guest is Stuart Copeland. The book is called Stuart Copeland's Police Diaries. It's going to be out this Thursday. There's a photo in the book of your home studio around 1977. It's full of guitars and tape reels and amps and the snare that you used in all the police recordings and tours. I think there's even like a vegetable box in there somewhere. And you write at the bottom of the blurb, as this book attests, I keep stuff.
Yes, I've still got all that gear.
Why do you keep it all?
I don't know. I just like it. I don't want to give it up. And I love old instruments. They just have a vibe to them. And there's a lot of mystique around. I'm not religious or superstitious, mm-hmm. but I am superstitious about instruments. I can feel the blues that have been played on this guitar, the heartbreak that has been expressed on that piece of equipment or whatever. I just like old gear.
Where were the diaries?
The diaries are in a drawer. They're very small. Physically, mm-hmm. they're very tiny. And so they only take up one drawer. Right back through high school, I was writing stuff, mostly gibberish.
When you say gibberish, do you mean it's your own personal code that yourself?
Of consciousness.
Okay.
It's for any of your listeners out there, writing is actually very therapeutic. If you're tangled up in blue, just start your mm-hmm. hand moving across the page, writing anything in any language. Doesn't have to be on topic or just write, and just somehow it dissipates the angst.
Let's go back to where the book starts. 1976, you're working with a band called Curved Air. How did you end up with Curved Air?
Well, I was their tour manager. My brother Miles had a music empire, mm-hmm. and that's where I learned. I started out roadieing for his groups, and then I made tour manager, and one of the bands I was tour managing was Curved Air, and the violin player and I had been just about to bust out with a group of our own. I came back from University of California at Berkeley, and we were about to form a group called Stark Naked and the Car Thieves. But Curved Air got a big tax bill, and so they had to go do a tour to pay this tax bill.
Oh, wow.
And darn, there goes my band, but I've still got my briefcase, and I had tour managing chops, so I became Curved Air's tour manager. Then when that tour finished and the drummer went off, they needed a drummer, so I joined the band. I was the last rat to jump aboard the sinking ship.
Well, let's listen to a song you co-wrote as a member of Curved Air. This is, I believe, Desiree?
Desiree.
Let's listen.
Where did you find it?
You haven't heard this in 15 years?
No.
Oh, the joy. If you do a deep dive on YouTube, you can find amazing things.
Yeah, well, those are my chords. It's my music, but the lyric came from somewhere else.
What was it like to hear that?
Oh, great. You know, with Curved Air, my first album that I ever recorded, actually, no, my first album was recorded at Berkeley with mm-hmm. this buddy who had a TIAC in his basement, self-released. Anyway, my first real record with Curved Air was rejected by the record company. And so they sent us back to the studio, some hotshot producers out of Miami, who killed the group, basically. They tried to turn mm-hmm. us into, I don't know, the Eagles or something, whereas we were gothic, you know, we were prog rock with noodly, 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 and that's sort of what the band's following was. We were prog. So they didn't get it. Mm. And the first version of the album disappeared into the mists of time until I finally digitized all the tapes I've got in a locker somewhere, and I found that album, which was so much better than the album that was eventually released. Mm. It had life, it had passion, it had creativity. It was like really cool. And that song that you just played a bit of there, I heard that song played with much more gusto and panache, but lost to the mists of time.
Hmm. What were the life lessons or the professional lessons from Curved Air that you
punk,
learned?
Punk rock. You know, to join a start a punk rock band was my rebellion against those two producers. You know, I get to the studio, and for our new producer to re-record the album, which we had so much fun making the album, we had to go and do it again. And they said, okay, go take a walk. We'll get your drum sound together. And I come back, and they have killed my drums. Mm. Buh, buh, oof. You know, for this, they're talking about, yeah, we got you a real nice fat back. What's a fat back? You mean, can I use some language on your station?
Can
I?
You can't, actually.
Okay.
No, but we got you.
What rhymes with nap?
Oh, you can use that one. That one's okay.
a nap, you know, back. And it was like the opposite. So I, you know, as soon as I could, I tuned my snare drum so high it would bring a bird down from the sky and just played louder, faster. You know, I didn't there because I was, you know, it hadn't. But my next band, man, I fixed that problem.
You did. Can we listen to Fallout?
Oh, yeah.
Let's listen. So that's you on guitar?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well, when the band started, we were, it was completely cynical. We wanted, you know, I wanted a punk band. I needed two guys. One of them needs to be the singer and play bass because I can't sing. And I found this Lion King guy up in Newcastle who could play bass and sing and had an amp.
Most importantly.
Yeah, most importantly. And actually, there was another feature that made him stand, which was the golden shaft of celestial light coming down from the heavens and alighting upon his magnificent brow. I mean, the guy had charisma out to here. Yeah. He could play bass, had his own amp, but that charisma thing. And I wasn't that concerned with singing quality because the punk scene was all about shouting. And but the material, I called him up from London after I'd seen his band in Newcastle. I said, hey, look, I've got this band, and by the way, I'm talking to you. I'm not interested in your band, just you. And he said, keep talking. And right there, I knew he was a free agent. Anyhow, a few weeks later, I get a call. Okay, it's me, Sting. I'm downstairs in a phone booth. Well, come on up. Mm-hmm. And he came up, and he's a complete stranger. And we plugged in and started playing, and the rest is history. But that's those songs at the beginning were all my dumb songs, just basically bass lines with yelling, and so that we could play the punk clubs.
You write about the origins of Roxanne. Friday, October 21st, 1977, one night in Paris when Sting was walking around the Saint-Germain red light district, and you add, it wasn't the first song that he wrote for the band, but it was the first to inspire the musical language that became our hybrid reggae signature sound. Do you remember being conscious of a shift towards that sound, or did it just happen organically?
Well, it was both. There was, in those days in the punk clubs, a lack of chill. And even punks, high on glue, guts to chill sometimes, but there's no such thing as punk chill music. And there was a DJ called Don Letts, who was playing in the, and he would play in between the punk tracks, he would play dark dub reggae, which is suitably hostile but chill. And so all these skinny white kids in London are hearing this music, which is hostile but really cool, and trying to figure it out. And all the drummers were listening. Wait a minute, what's he doing? The kick and the snare together on three? What? And I think it was the Clash was the first band to try it. But I had a secret weapon. My secret sauce was that I grew up in the Arab world, where the Arabic music, the debki, there's the dance, the baladi rhythms of the country music, has the same building blocks. The emphasis on the third beat of the bar, you hide the one, two, three, four, two, three, four, two, three, you know. And so to play music back to front, reggae style came really easy to me, and we could do it more naturally.
That's so interesting. Yeah, you were born in Virginia, and your dad was in the CIA, so you grew up in Beirut, correct?
Well,
you lived in Beirut for a while.
Yeah, I left America when I was 2 months old, and from there to Cairo, where my father was busy installing a dictator, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was actually very good for Egypt. And then to Beirut, where I played in my first band in the American Community School in Beirut, and was surrounded by Arabic music.
That's so interesting. Okay, now I'm going to listen to Roxanne with a new set of information.
Oh, by the way, just before you do,
yeah.
So Sting brings in this bossa nova track kind of as an afterthought. It totally did not fit our profile at all, but it's just such a great song. And what can we do? So I turned the beat backwards, make the one into two and the two into three, et cetera. And that just clicked.
Let's listen. This is Roxanne from The Police. Sting sat on the piano during that song?
Well, he's waiting, the tape starts rolling, he's waiting for his vocal entrance, and behind him there's a piano, and he sits down, not realizing that the lid was up, so he sits down and plays a butt chord, B flat minor, I think, and laughs because it was so ridiculous, and it was just a spontaneous, real moment. We love that stuff.
My guest is Stuart Copeland. The name of the book is Stuart Copeland's Police Diaries, due out this Thursday. One of the diaries gives you a sense what it's like to be a working musician. This entry from 78, German checks cannot be cleared, so I'm stuck with no home, no car insurance, no money, and some stiff debts. When you think back on those, and when you think back on those times, how desperate were you?
Desperate.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the first entries of 1978 is... I'm out of money. I've got 15 quid to last me till my next lucky break.
Wow.
And that came very soon.
Mm-hmm.
And as my record is, the Clark Kent record is getting picked up and is being played on the airways, I'm experiencing my first hit. It's all going on as I'm being evicted through because I couldn't pay my rent. We were paid in Deutschmarks for this gig that we did in Germany, but the bank manager says, I don't know from Deutschmarks, I'm sorry, but I've been banking here since I was 14. Well, as a musician, that's a cash economy. All the cash went straight into my pocket and straight into buying a curry dinner or a truck or a roadie or whatever, And so I didn't, you don't exist. You have nothing in your bank account. So he let me get thrown out of my apartment because he wouldn't lend me the money to pay my rent. Next time I turn it, you can take my 17 pounds and transfer it to Coots, who are helping me buy my first house. Thank you very much.
Gauntlet thrown. The first time you, Sting, and Andy appeared together on TV, it wasn't a Police performance. It was for your solo single, Don't Care. Here's an entry from August 29th, 1978, a couple days before it aired. They got me on Top of the Pops, Surrey Sound, recorded a reggae riff jam, started recording Don't Care for BBC. BBC chaps came and watched. We were all in masks. Sounds great. We were all in masks?
Well, Clark Kent was a secret identity. Since the Police was so uncool, unhip, had been spotted by the London critics as carpetbaggers, I figured, how about I do this Clark Kent record incognito? And so I wore masks and I would do interviews. When it got played and became a hit, I was doing interviews with Sounds Magazine, Melody Maker and such, in a mask with a completely different bogus story every time. I'm a archaeologist working in Egypt, and I found these lyrics written on the tomb of Perneftah the III,
That's hilarious.
And then the next time I talk to him, I'm a coal miner in Wales and whatever. And so the first time we were on TV, and I'm glad you brought this up, because it does bring me to my favorite brag of all, which is the first time the Three Blonde Heads was on national TV was as, thank you, my backing band. Even though I sang and played all the instruments on the record, a truly solo act, when I had a hit and went on Top of the Pops, I didn't want to be that guy standing there. I'm not into singers. I'm into bands. Mm. And so I got my chuckle buddies to join me on stage. And now, all these years later, after all that's happened, there's old Stingo in a gorilla mask miming, oh, dear folks, this is the reward of life, miming my bass line. Thank you. He did get his revenge, you know, but just for that little moment in time until the police came along and crushed everything in its path.
Well, let's savor the moment when we listen to Don't Care from Clark Kent.
It's kind of dumb.
I am the hottest thing you ever will see. You know I'm something it ain't easy to be. I am the neatest thing that ever hit town. There isn't anything that could bring me down. Don't care if you really wanna hang around. Don't care, cause I am the neatest thing in town. Don't care if you really wanna stick around. I don't care if you even wanna put me down. The girls are always trying to settle me down. They never guess I'm only fooling around.
That is Clark Kent. My guest is Stuart Copeland. Okay, so you're reissuing a Clark Kent record, and that's the 17th November?
Yes,
maybe?
Yes. And it's not just the record and a few more recordings since then, but also the home demo of every one of the songs.
Oh, wow.
Because I was a home recording enthusiast, and I would demo the songs on my TIAC 4-track and my Revox A77. And I digitized, and I've got the demo version of each one of these songs, including a version of that song you just heard with poor old Stingo singing it. That's how broad-minded he was. I feel guilty that I put him through that. He's a man of such depth, dignity. To hear him singing that dumb song. Stingo, I'm sorry.
Do you call him Stingo to his face?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
If it's not, hey, listen, pal.
buddy, buckaroo. So we have that. We have Police Deranged for Orchestra, which is really cool. The orchestrated versions of Police songs. Police Beyond Borders.
Which is even cooler.
Right?
So
we're all kinds of musicians in different languages.
How about this? Every Breath You Take in Zulu, complete with the clicking.
It's so cool. How did you end up doing all of this at the same time? How did this all end up sort of just being in this year?
Well, it was done sequentially, but kind of it's all appearing at the same time.
Ah, gotcha.
I made the first version, Police Deranged for Orchestra, which is these messed up versions where I cut the songs up and mixed them all up and then scored it for full orchestra. And that's the show that I've been doing for the last couple of years. And I made the record. It actually got to number 2 in the classical crossover charts and number 3 in the actual classical charts, which makes me ask, where was Mozart that week? Kind of cool. And then I thought, well, that's great. Okay. But my buddy, Ricky Cage, with whom I won Grammys for the last 2 years, said, hey, send me those backing tracks. And I sent them to him, and he fires up the Soweto Gospel Choir, Sui Jian from China, huge, multi-gazillion-selling Chinese artist. Serge Tankian sings one song, Demolition Man, in Armenian, and all these Hindi versions. And it's the global version of the same album.
First of all, let's say thank you to Stuart Copeland for coming in.
Ah, shucks.
This was really fun. The book is really gorgeous. It's a really good read, and it's beautifully art-directed. And we're going to go out on Can't Stand Losing You from Police Beyond Borders.
I called you so many times a day, and I guess it's all true what your girlfriends say, that you don't ever want to see me again. And your brother's gonna kill me, and he's 6'10". I guess you'd call it cowardice, but I'm not prepared to go on like this.
I can't stand losing.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.